My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Department Oral History Project. And today, April 3rd, 2006, I'm interviewing Professor Karen Steudel, who is the current chair of the UW-Madison Zoology Department. Good afternoon, Karen.
Good afternoon, Sandy.
We'll just start with this list of questions.
Okay.
And first of all, I'd like to know where and when you were born, if you could describe your childhood and your early schooling, talk about any family members, teachers, or others who encouraged you in your studies.
Okay. So I was born in Providence, Rhode Island on September 25th, 1946. Within my first year of birth, moved to Dubuque, Iowa, where my mother's parents lived. She and my father had only, he was of course away at World War II in the Navy, and when he came back, he stayed in the Navy a little bit, but then shortly thereafter, they moved out to Dubuque, where they lived for a little while, or a year or two with my grandparents, and then got their own place. So my first few years of life, I mostly lived with my parents, but my grandparents were also an important part of my life because they lived in the same city and were just very, enjoying the whole grandchild kind of thing. And then when I was probably 4 or 5, we moved to Freeport, Illinois, where I did a lot of my growing up. It was a nice middle class family. I'm the first person in my direct line of descent to have a college degree, but I had relatives like an uncle. In fact, I think I had maybe a couple of uncles who were on the faculty in a couple of places. So, my family valued education. I can't remember ever thinking or ever questioning whether I would go to college or not. Everybody just assumed that I would. I guess I would say that my family in general was somewhat outdoorsy. Like people liked to walk, people liked to garden, and I think they were probably, in effect, ganging up on me to make me interested in biology. I think I probably never really had a chance. And I loved animals growing up.
Did you have any?
Oh, of course. I had dogs my whole life. And I rode ponies, and though I never had one of my very own. And I just found animals nice, fun, fascinating. It was just really interesting to get to know a member of another species and get a sense of what was going through their minds. I always did well in school, and it was just, my family had fairly high expectations, and so I was kind of expected to be good at things, and so I, did what I needed to do to be good at academics. I liked academics. It wasn't like it was something that was hard for me to do. I was also, I loved sports, and I was also good at sports, so, it's not that I was particularly, the academics were the main thing, but they certainly were important to me. I grew up, though, in a situation where all the women I knew were chiefly housewives, and I knew that there were a few women who were nurses and teachers, but there weren't that many of them. And I have to say, and by teacher I mean K through 12 teachers, and I have to say that neither of those occupations really appealed to me. I thought nursing seemed kind of yucky, and it also seemed like, this is probably the only feminist thought that occurred to me before sort of the onset of feminism, many, many years later. It just seemed like the doctors bossed nurses around all the time, and I just didn't think I wanted to be in that kind of a position. As far as teachers, I knew what some of my classmates behaved like, and I really didn't want to have to deal with that age of person. So I, and of course, as I say, most women I knew were housewives. So I grew up assuming I would be a housewife, but not really thinking much about it until high school. And I can remember when I thought about it in high school that I actually was, I think, a little depressed for a while because I kind of didn't see my mother's life being, I mean, you know, she was a very happy woman, happily married, I mean, and loved her life and still loves her life. And so she was very happy in her life. But when I looked at it, it just seemed like that really wasn't what I wanted to do. But I didn't see any options, so I just assumed I would. But then I went to college. I went to University of Wisconsin, Madison.
Now, how did you choose Madison?
I always knew that when I was growing up that I would go to the major public university in whatever state my parents happened to be in at the time. And so it was, you know, they lived in Wisconsin at the time, so it was UW-Madison.
Now, where did they live in Wisconsin?
Beaver Dam.
Oh. Okay.
And I lived there for a year, and then happily came down to Madison and was thrilled. So it was not like so that's some of the questions that you say about why UW-Madison. You know, I never really had a chance. This is where I came, but I just was thrilled. I just loved it. And I loved the higher level of academics. I loved Madison and living with a bunch of kids in college as opposed to in the small little Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. So, yes, I was an enthusiast.
There was a lot of activity going on campus
sure
that had nothing
was.
To do with going to class during
yeah.
that time.
Yeah, that's
did you get involved in that?
A little bit. That really was more toward the end of my college career, or undergraduate career, and then a little bit into graduate school. Mm-hmm. The demonstrations were going on. And I was, you couldn't not be politically aware here back then. I thought I was against the war. However, I was against things where people would not allow the other side to speak. I thought that, you know, one should try to hear both sides of the story, even though my personal view was that the war was a mistake. And so I wasn't a fervent demonstrator. Mm-hmm. I would sometimes go to demonstrations, but I was not a particular rabble rouser or a particularly dedicated protester. So, those were interesting times. The main thing I remember was when I was doing my graduate work, that there was a lot of that going on, mm-hmm. and you know, one was always very, very careful to keep one copy of one's data at work mm-hmm. and one copy of one's data and manuscripts at home, just in case something happened.
Sure.
I think the only time I was tear gassed was coming out of a final examination in Bascom Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And there were protesters in the Commerce Building at that point, and they were getting tear gassed, and I left by one of the back exits, and my eyes started to run pretty fast. But so I was very much aware of those and interested and, you know, concerned, but I was kind of an academic. And if I wasn't an academic, I was doing sports.
Mm-hmm. What sports were you involved in?
I guess back then I liked to play tennis mm-hmm. a fair amount, but I would do other sports. Tennis was the only, I guess, and I liked to ride my bike mm-hmm. As well around mm-hmm. town. So I would say biking and tennis were probably my main ones at that point. I've done others at various other times, but it was just fun to be active. My first 2 years here, my grades were not very good. The reason for this was that my father decreed that I was going to get a degree in education. And as I mentioned, this was not really my idea. I really didn't want to go into education, and I really didn't think highly of the education one got in that context. I'm not sure how tactful I'm supposed to be.
You can be as tactful as you want.
Okay.
So I
really didn't want, and at that time, and I don't know what it is now, to be an okay student in letters and science, you only had to maintain a 2.0 average, and to get into the School of Education, you needed to have a 2.5 average. So uh-huh. My objective was to keep my grade point above a 2.0, but below a 2.5. And so typically, I would just, the first part of the semester, I would just sort of be normal. And then when I get my 6 weeks grade, I would panic and calculate, you know, sort of what I needed to do to keep my grade point in the between the 2.0 and 2.5. But then in my junior year, I married my first husband, and this is so, you know, it's weird talking about this stuff. This was so long ago, and the culture was so different back then. I'm sure you remember.
Yes.
In the ride in the car. So my husband at that point was, you know, a young man. The Vietnam War was going on. And at that point, he had a draft deferment. Of course, later he went into the lottery like everybody else. And so instead of going on a honeymoon, we went directly to Milwaukee, where his draft deferred job was. On the way, I said, "Harry, do you care if I, you know, major in education, or can I major in whatever I want?" And because I thought, you know, my father had handed me off to my husband, and I thought I had to ask permission, which, you know, by those standards, I did. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Of course not, major in whatever you want." So I no longer had to keep the old grade point down. And so it was, you know, a very freeing experience. So then I had to unfortunately transfer to UW-Milwaukee, in Milwaukee, and I have to say I hated going there. All these advanced senior level courses that I was starting to come up that I could take here and was so excited about taking, of course they didn't offer, mm-hmm. and so I ended up just taking some courses that to fulfill their requirements for the zoology degree, which was kind of boring, and I really noticed the reduction in quality of the students and the faculty, and so it was kind of a sad way, really, to end one's undergraduate career. Although I think I actually, maybe I was only there as an undergrad a semester, so mostly I did my stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing is that my husband thought I should get a job, and so I looked on campus for a job, and I happened to get a job with an anthropology faculty member whose name was Neil Tappan. In my, I think, last semester here, I had taken the local course in evolution, gotten completely hooked on evolution, and particularly human evolution. The person who taught the course was my later major professor, John Robinson, who worked mm-hmm. on early hominids and early hominid evolution. And I loved evolution. I loved early hominid evolution. So the idea of getting a job with a physical anthropologist, as this person was, had a, you know, really large appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the good news about going to Milwaukee. As I and being married, my husband said I needed to get a job. I got a job with a physical anthropologist, and started hanging out with physical anthropologists. And I noticed that I could hold my own really well, even with graduate students in physical anthropology with that group. And I started thinking, you know, maybe I could do this. And I went to Dr. Tappan, my mentor at that point, and I asked him one day, do you think I could go to graduate school in this field? And he just burst out laughing, and I was so embarrassed because I thought he was thinking there's no way. But then he said, of course you could go, you know, be a graduate. You'd be an excellent graduate. You want to go, you know, go to grad school? Let me know. And I had never crossed my mind. I had never seen a career I wanted before that. And of course, I didn't see it in terms of a career. I never saw it in terms of a career until I was almost had my PhD. I saw myself as just learning everything I could about human evolution. And that the way you did that was you went to graduate school. Mm-hmm. And so I saw graduate school purely as a cool thing to do to learn about human evolution. I never made the link to being a faculty member afterwards. It just, that just wasn't on my radar screen. So at that point then I went from person with very, with no career expectations whatever, to a person who knew what she wanted to do with the next few years of her life, but then I didn't really look beyond graduate school. It just, you know, there were very few women faculty members mm-hmm. at that time, although there were a few. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, I guess I at that point knew it was possible because I saw that, you know, some of them doing it.
And so what year was that? When you were you still in Milwaukee when you made up your mind you wanted to do this?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But then did you go to graduate school in Milwaukee?
What did I do? Did I get a I got a master's at UW Milwaukee, okay. And then I came here for PhD. And the way I worked it was, I was never too interested in cultural anthropology, and I like zoology. I think there's a lot of really interesting things going on in zoology. I think if I were a grad student now, I would probably do something with genomics. I think that's such an interesting field. So I really like zoology. Only like physical anthropology, biological anthropology. So the way I worked it is I had a nominal major professor in the zoology department at Milwaukee. I think his name was Bayer, something like that. And then Dr. Tappan was my real the person who really advised me. Mm-hmm. And so I did some work on hind limb musculature comparative across a variety of primates for my master's, which was reasonably interesting, but I was really wanting to study human evolution rather than comparative anatomy of primates. So then I, my ex-husband and I decided that we would go back to graduate school, and I applied and wanted to go to Madison because it's just, you know, much, much, much better quality. So I came and worked with John Robinson, mm-hmm. and he came to mechanical engineering and worked with Sam Wu. Mm-hmm. And so we made the move back to Madison. I was so happy. Milwaukee is an interesting town, but sort of the things that you can do at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and as far as I'm concerned, in the city of Madison, are just completely superior mm-hmm. to what was available at Milwaukee. So I was delighted to come back here, and so I just completely threw myself into graduate work. We lived in Eagle Heights. And so I could ride my bike, you know, into work easily and back, except in the wintertime, of course. And I just loved it, just loved it. I loved my courses. I did a bunch of genetics just because I found genetics extremely interesting and, of course, relevant to human evolution in a variety of ways. I briefly considered doing a PhD minor in genetics. But they actually had a lot of, instead of the usual fixed number of credits, they had a bunch of specific courses that you had to take, mm-hmm. some of which were not interesting to me. So I ended up minoring in anthropology, which made a lot more sense in any case, given my interests. So I was a maniac in graduate school. I loved it. I just loved it. It was one of the best times of my life.
Well, it sounds like your undergraduate education was odd in
yeah.
the sense that you purposely had to keep your grades down, then you had to go to Milwaukee,
mm-hmm.
so I can imagine
yeah.
that this was...
That's true. This was a choice, whereas the other things were kind of a little bit more constrained. So, yeah, I just had a ball. My idea of a fun Friday or Saturday night was to go down to... Back at that time, we had to do computing at the Dayton Street Center mm-hmm. down in the basement with using big cards, you know, boxes of cards. And my idea of a good time was to head on down there and take advantage of the fact that there weren't that many other people there, so you get fast turnaround and you also got lower rates. So that was pretty much where I wanted to be on the weekends. And I think the fact that my husband and I were both working on our degrees and we're both spending a lot of time on that, I mean, we still would do fun things, but we didn't, I don't think we had a vacation until we had our PhDs, probably. I mean, yeah, in fact, I'm sure we didn't. But
how were you funded?
I was funded at UW Milwaukee for my master's. I TA'd. Mm-hmm. And then when I came here, I don't remember what I did initially. I had an NSF doctoral dissertation improvement thing to fund a trip to Africa to study the hominid fossils and to collect data on a variety of postcranial samples of primates. And
now, did you go off by yourself?
Yeah, I went all by myself at age 21. 22, must have been 22, maybe 23. I was pretty young, and yes, I went off to Europe and then Africa all by myself to collect my data. And I was thrilled at the prospect, because I'd never been to Europe at that point, and I'd certainly never been to Africa. And so I kind of went along being thrilled until I for some reason got a flight out of Chicago, probably for cheap, rather than out of Madison. And so my husband took me down to Chicago, and we were sitting waiting for my flight in O'Hare. And I just found myself thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be on my own. My husband isn't going to be there. You know, whom I was really used to seeing and relying on and having him around for support. And I realized he wasn't going to be for 2 or 3 months for this trip. And so that was kind of daunting. Mm-hmm. But then when I got to England, which was my first stop, I could not believe it. Things here are so new. Things here, in the U.S. are mm-hmm. so new, and there they have all these things that are so old. I was just overwhelmed by that, and I found I didn't mind being on my own, over that kind of a short time interval. There was so much to see and do in the mm-hmm. places that I was that I just. It was great, and I loved working in museums. I liked talking with the people whose collections I was working on. And so I actually had a really good time mm-hmm. and, was able to, visit European art museums for the first time. It was just wonderful, really. And I would spend the evenings reading, mm-hmm. a lot of times, and I had a lot to do and had a lot of interests, and so that was really nice. And then in Africa, oh my goodness, there are all these, I got to see these fossils of early mm-hmm. humans, and I just couldn't believe it. And of course there were all these really well-known people in the field at the same museums at the same time, and often you'd all be in the same room working on different specimens. And so you could talk to anybody you wanted to talk to. Hmm. And so I learned so much. And then a lot of people, I stayed at the worst hotel anywhere near the National Museums of Kenya where I was working, because it was also the cheapest hotel. There were other people who were working at National Museums of Kenya who were also staying there, but anyone stayed in a different hotel that was not quite as bad as ours. A little perspective on that, it was full board, but the scrambled eggs were in the morning were gray.
Oh dear.
How do you get gray scrambled eggs? I mean, you sort of didn't want to know.
No.
But again, there'd be groups of people that would hang out after dinner and sit around and talk about fossils. And it was just like heaven. Mm-hmm. And here's another tidbit evocative of the era. So this was back when Louis and Mary Leakey were still alive. Although Louis Leakey, I think, died a few months after I left. He invited me out to his house to have dinner with his family one night. He was well known for liking young women a lot more than he liked young men.
I see.
The whole, like, you know, Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall, that's
right.
How they kind of got into that
okay.
business. And so this was well known. And so, of course, I knew I got out there just because I was a young woman. And it was hilarious because all the young men, of course, he kept a lot of specimens at home, and there were some that we wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew what specimens he had at his house that I wanted to see while I was out there. But then all these young men would come around saying, listen, could you find out if he has, you know, all these little things that they wanted, because they knew they were never going to get out
sure.
there because they were guys. I mean, it was just such reverse discrimination. So that was kind of amusing. And so I had dinner with Louis Leakey and his family out at his house. Mm-hmm. He drove me out there. It was hair-raising. He's an outrageous driver, and of course African traffic is pretty outrageous, you know, even if you're careful. So we went out to his place, and he was this really remarkable man. He was old, you know, and he was kind of not getting around as well as I'm sure he had previously. But he was a smoker. He was a drinker. He said that his doctors told him if he didn't give up both, he was going to be dead. But he figured that was fine. He wasn't going to give it up because he was just going to go for it. And indeed, he was dead a few months later. But he just, you know, he'd made his choices. And he was an outrageous guy. He was completely sexist. If I would ask him questions, he seemed, in spite of, like, Jane Goodall had already been doing lots of her work at that time,
mm-hmm.
and she did excellent work, and so he should have figured out that women are perfectly capable. His wife Mary was very capable. You know, that he saw capable women everywhere. Nonetheless, it was clear. He would say things like, when I would ask a question, he'd say, "Very good," you know, which he would never have said. And, you know, no one. It was just, he was very, very sexist. But on the other hand, he liked women. So, like, I mean, without him, Jane Goodall or Diane Fossey never would have gotten their start. So it's kind of a strange mix with him. And then I went to South Africa, where I just had, you know, again, an excellent time looking at fossils. This was where my advisor had worked initially, and his mentor also. I had worked mm-hmm. in the Transvaal Museum in South Africa. So again, I basically kind of lived, ate, and slept early hominid fossils and loved it. And so then I came back. And wrote up my dissertation, and now my office was next to my advisor's office in this building. And every once in a while, I would hear him on the phone talking to someone who, and I knew they had asked him if he had any good graduate students coming up along, and he would talk about me, and so I'm thinking. You know, he obviously thinks I'm going to get a job. People are obviously thinking, you know, that I might be a faculty member. And so, you know, I'd go home and kick that around with my husband. And I guess we kind of thought, well, you know, that's a way of doing more of what you like to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when I got my PhD, I went on the job market. And got a number of offers at SUNY Stony Brook, University of Pittsburgh, and I was getting a little more than nibbles at the University of Washington, Seattle. But then I got a job here as a lecturer, which was good because my ex-husband was finishing up, going on the job market. Mm-hmm. He got a job at Marquette University in Milwaukee, and as an engineer, Seattle would have been a horrible place for him to go. At that point, it was when Boeing was laying off everybody, and so the job market for engineers in Seattle was notoriously awful. So we chose, and of course, we thought it was much more important for the guy to have a job than the woman. Mm-hmm. And so he got a professorship at Marquette, I got a lectureship here, and that was what we chose because it seemed to kind of fit with our expectations, which were a product of our time.
Sure.
So I was a lecturer here for 2 years, and then and a faculty job came open, which I applied for and got. And so then the third year I was on the faculty here.
And you've been here ever since?
Yes, I've been here ever since. So sounds boring, but of course in the faculty business, your job can change day to day and does change so much.
I'm sure.
Over the course of a career, so I haven't found it dull at all.
One of the questions here is, what had you heard about the reputation of the department? Well, you had heard everything you needed to know. You were part of it.
Yeah. Although the one thing that was I think a mistake about going to the place that you got your PhD, and I think it may. I think it's an intrinsic problem with that. Is everybody assumed I knew how things worked here? But of course, as a graduate student, you don't really know how things work at the faculty level. So there was a ton of stuff, and my advisor, of course, had spent most of his career in South Africa, had lived in and grown up in South Africa, and then had most of his scientific career in South Africa. So he really didn't know the American system, and he didn't come into the American system as a full professor who was very, very well known. Mm-hmm. And so sort of the being an assistant professor, he had no clue. And so he didn't pass that along to me. And I guess I have to say the chair of the department at that time wasn't really quite up front with me about the rules of being an assistant professor and what it took to get tenure. And so that was kind of a difficult time. And of course, I was the first woman hired in my department under the same deal as men. There had been other women who were academic staff and hired just to teach. But actually there was one woman in the other, in our other side, in developmental biology, who I knew slightly, who didn't get tenure about the time I arrived, maybe the year after I arrived, whose name was Marion Namenworth.
A familiar name to me.
Well, that she then sued the university, and so there was a big history with that. And I just stayed out of that. At that time, I think that was probably the only good political instinct that I had was just to stay out of that because I knew it was a huge issue in the department. So I guess I was the second. I think her deal maybe was like a guy too, and so I may be the second one hired, but the first one tenured, who was able to stay. So it was kind of strange being the only woman. In the department, but initially I didn't see that as such a big deal because I had no trouble dealing with men, and I didn't see it as that big a deal. But in retrospect, I realized that I was given a teaching load roughly double what the men were given, and not out of any malice, I don't think. I think it was just that you hire women, they teach. That's what you hire them to do. That's their job, is teaching. And so, of course, they have a higher teaching load than men. And so I think I was given the teaching load of the old women who are academic staff.
Oh, sure.
Who were expected only to teach. And I was told that teaching was equal, doing a good job teaching was equal to doing a good job doing research, which was not true, of course. And so it was just, I was spending my first couple of years, I was just teaching my little heart out. And I really wanted to get to my research, but I wasn't able to get to it as much as, you know, as a person, you know, as a man could have, who had the man's teaching load as opposed to the women's teaching load. So that was pretty, my assistant professor days were pretty unpleasant. I mean, there were some great guys that, you know, I just, you know, some of the guys that were my colleagues that are my colleagues now, and some of them are good friends and supporters, and were really great. But the people in charge of the department were older men mm-hmm. who had more fixed ideas about women, and I don't, again, I don't think there was any malice. It's just that they had these views of what women should be, mm-hmm. and they tried to give me that, but if I'd taken that, I wouldn't be here now. You know, so it was, that was pretty awkward.
Was there any opportunity for networking across campus for women in your situation?
If there were, I didn't know about. There was no plan for that. Mm-hmm. And there were so few women, you know, that, you know, where would you find one? Mm-hmm. You know, and so it, and in fact, I remember going home and talking with my husband, and we, and both of us sitting down trying to figure out, was it me or was it that I was a woman? Hmm. And, you know, I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't decide if I was being treated like this just because I was me or because I was a woman. So it was a very weird time mm-hmm. In my life. It was, you know, much less happy times. I would hear, you know, I guess I felt things weren't going too well for me, and I was starting to think of other alternatives. And some people who work in my field teach in medical schools because they know human anatomy really well. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, and there were a fair number of those around. I was thinking, well, geez, maybe I should, you know, bail and you know, apply for some of those you know, gross anatomy positions. And I mentioned that, at this point it's too long ago, but I thought only to like one colleague in passing up here in Birch Hall. And then the same colleague told me that in the next faculty meeting, the chair of the department told the executive committee that sort of tenuring me versus not maybe wouldn't be a problem because I was going to apply to medical school.
Oh my.
You know, just not that I was going to go for a faculty job. You know, it was just there was a lot of weird stuff. You know, some of my senior colleagues wouldn't be alone in a room with me. And I think it was over the Mary Namonworth thing that they were, you know, they'd been deposed on that, and they sort of didn't want to be deposed when anything with me. It was just extremely weird. After a couple of years, I went down and told the department chair that my teaching load was such that I just, you know, didn't think I could get enough research done to be competitive for tenure. And so I actually offered to drop to half time so I could have my teaching load. And to do him justice, this is the guy who'd been lying to me all along about what it took to get tenure. He said, you stay full time. We'll have your teaching load. So then I went back to probably more or less what the guys were doing, in terms of teaching.
But that you helped. Had to catch up more or less then.
Well, yeah, well, in terms of research, but I had more time, and so I had a much better shot at that. So, but I think I did. I think I did good work, and in fact, I did get tenure. I must say, it was probably a somewhat close thing, but I don't know. I think my letters were pretty good, you know, quibbling about number of publications, but not about the quality. And I don't know. Anyway, so I and my teaching evaluations were very good. So anyway, I made it.
Good for you.
Yep.
Describe the culture of your department. I'm getting a little bit of an idea.
It's really different now.
Is it?
It's so different now. Uh-huh. Back then, I was the only woman.
And how many women are there now?
We have, among our junior faculty, mm-hmm. half are women.
Oh my, that's great.
Actually, I think now slightly less than half because a couple of them just got tenure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so our hiring has been 50-50. I'd have to add them up, but around 6 to 8, and we're a total of 25. Mm-hmm. But among the junior faculty, it's pretty equal. There are only 2 of us among full professors.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's just that there weren't many hires after me for quite a while. For a while, they were mostly men, but then more recently, it's been equal, and there was no effort done to do that. It was just that we tried to hire the best candidate,
mm-hmm.
and in half the cases, the best candidate was the woman, and so we now have a good thing. My answering machine is terrible, so if you don't mind. Where were we?
Culture of the department, how it's changed.
Well, okay, so... back then, it was a very different department than it is now. It was, they had a lot of good people. However, in general, the grants and the grant overheads were brought in chiefly by the people in our zoology research building, and zoology research means cell molecular developmental biology. So those were the guys that were bringing in the big bucks. The people who lived in the Burge Hall tended to be ecology, evolution, and like physiology, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of the people in Burge Hall had significant grants. They may have had small little ones, but they weren't generating a lot of overhead. And the culture was that because the guys in zoo research were doing all this grant generation, they didn't teach much, and because the guys in Burge Hall were not getting grants, they did the teaching. And so it was very much two almost different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I lived in this world where you didn't get grants, but you did a lot of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess other things, what would I say about Burge Hall? It was a lot easier going back then than it is now. People weren't worried about getting grants. They were worried about getting their research done. Most of the people around here kind of, there were some fairly well-known people,
mm-hmm.
but not nearly as well-known as what we have now. And, research took the time it took. And so it was a much, much more laid-back place to be than it is now. And again, we did have, I overlapped very briefly on the faculty with John Emlin, the famous, famous animal behaviorist who was the mentor of George Schaller, who did the mountain gorilla work.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of other well-known students. So it was really kind of his lab was a major powerhouse in behavior, but he retired very shortly after I came on the faculty, so he wasn't part of the culture for very long. So it was a very much laid back place then, in a general way. Now things are very different. Okay. Now things are very different. People up here have substantial federal grants. Our total revenues and total overheads are not nearly as great as they are down in cell molecular now, but nearly everybody up here is really working on getting grants, on getting the publications that will bring them another grant down the line. So it's become a much higher pressure environment. I also have to say that I think the amount of research and the quality of research being done in Burge Hall has increased substantially. And now, in fact, we have 2 members of the National Academy in our department. Both are in the integrated zoology side. We don't have any in the cell molecular side, even though there's some really excellent people down there. And so I guess I would say now that the culture has changed so that the 2 areas are equal, much more equal in terms of research prominence, and more equal in terms of grants, although they still have more than we have. And also along the way, we got rid of some faculty from the Zoll Research side who were difficult and who wanted not to teach very much and were successful in doing that because of their research preeminence. And we've gotten new faculty in down in Zoll Research who take their teaching responsibilities very seriously. I would say at this point there is not a difference in the amount of teaching done by Zoll Research versus Burge Hall. Mm-hmm. And again, of course, it's gone from an environment where there was one woman who was equal to the men in her job description, to an area where there are many women, which makes all the difference. Sure. In the world. So yes, times have changed.
What courses have you taught?
I've taught, I have taught and do teach Zoology 101. When I first came here, this is a course that is three credits and two lecture sections a day for a total of approximately 900 students, and it's offered each semester. And when I first started teaching, I would teach all of one section of that by myself, which was not only is that a huge number of students to have, but it's also you have to cover all of zoology, you know. So I had to cover molecular biology and cell biology and ecology and things very far from my own discipline. So it was getting up to speed in that course was a real humdinger. I also early on taught organic evolution, and I taught in the BioCore program also for a semester, and until I was chair, I taught a course called Animal Structural Design, which is the evolution of animal structure, basically, which was a smaller course, very fun to teach, very much in my own area, so like about 30 to 35 students. Okay, my first couple of years here, I was teaching so much that I just would get the lectures ready and give them. And I didn't have much time to think outside the box. Plus, back in those days, lecturing was how it was done. I mean, people didn't think about other ways of teaching and this whole idea of like group learning or active learning. You know, nobody'd heard of any of those things. Mm-hmm. So it was very much straight lecture back in those days, although I was in BioCore, I was also involved with doing a little with the labs. Since I've gotten older, of course, all these ideas about group learning, about interaction, even in large lecture halls, that sort of thing, have gotten more popular. And there's not too much I've done with that in Zoology 101. It's a class of 450. I have since the beginning encouraged them to ask questions, which depending on the class, sometimes people do, sometimes people don't. And there's a whole clicker technology now that people are using. We have not gone to clickers yet in Zoology 101. Initially when I heard about it, I loved the idea, but I've been to a couple of workshops on clickers and they don't seem to work.
Will you explain that?
Oh, the idea of clickers is that every student has a little, like a little mouse that they, that if you put something on a screen saying, which do you think is right, and you have some answers A, B, C, D, E, they can all push and select one.
Oh, okay.
And then this teacher knows what the students are thinking, mm-hmm. and can respond to that. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of knowing what my students are thinking at the time. But to the extent that I've been in clicker workshops, they don't seem to work very well. Mm. And the class, the size of my 450 students would just swamp out the clicker system, and it would just not really function. Mm-hmm. So I may get involved with that if the technology improves a little bit. But I guess the main thing is in my little animal structural design class, I have gone to kind of having a little bit of a lab experience where they work in groups, and it's much more participatory and much more hands-on and them kind of guiding their research experience. And it's awfully time-consuming, but it's also fun for me. Because you're really teaching them, in a very immediate way, and also the students. The course evaluation suggests that students really like doing it that way mm-hmm. as well. So I guess I would say that would be probably my main innovation. That and taking over the honors program, where again it's a very collegial, interactive mm-hmm. approach.
Have there been students that you mentored that particularly stand out in your mind, good or bad?
happily, mostly good. Mm-hmm. I've just been really, really, really happy with the quality of the undergrads who've worked in my lab. I was initially hesitant to allow undergraduates to collect data, but then as a result of having gotten a job offer elsewhere, I was able to get a new piece of equipment in my mm-hmm. lab that made the kind of data that I collect much easier to collect, and also it gives a kind of printout that allows that if a student does it, I can then go back and see what happened minute to minute in the course of the trial, mm-hmm. and so if there's a screw up, I can detect it and deal with it. So since then, I've had a number of undergraduates doing independent projects in my lab, mm-hmm. and I have just been so impressed with their quality. I've had a couple that weren't wonderful, but most of them have been really very, very good, and I've had very positive interactions, and they seem happy, and it's made for a very kind of fun way to run the lab. Mm-hmm. I've had some. I guess probably my best ever graduate student is next door. She's on the faculty at St. Catherine's College in Minnesota, and she's here. She's on sabbatical, mm-hmm. and so she's just here for a few days to work on a manuscript that we're working on together. Mm-hmm. And she's just so smart and so analytical and such a technology wonk that it was fun having her mm-hmm. as a student. There have been many more.
Talked about your research, and you talked about where your research interests have come from. Can you talk about some of the questions that you explore in your research, the substance of your research?
Sure. Let me sort of put this again in my research twists and turns. It doesn't follow a very clear pathway sometimes, or at least mine doesn't. So I started out working on human evolution, and my first publication involved establishing that the earliest known hominids, which would be the genus Australopithecus, I'm not sure if you've ever heard that term, but that they walked on two legs. And so I've been working on that sort of thing. And then I also did something on how does one analyze fossils that differ substantially in body size in terms of their adaptations to locomotion or diet, whatever. Mm-hmm. If you have a gigantic skull that has gigantic teeth and a small skull that has small teeth, are these doing different things? Are those teeth, kind of what you need to eat the same food at the smaller body size? Or, and there are substantial differences in body size throughout the course of human evolution. We started out quite small. And, or I should say quite fairly small, the males weren't that small. And of course are much larger now, and in Neanderthal times the body mass would have been higher, although probably not stature. And so I did some work on trying to figure out the consequences and implications of those sorts of things. So that was fun. Mm-hmm. Chiefly what one did in physical anthropology back in those days is you'd say, well, okay, let's say a fossil has short limbs. What would be the consequences of that? Well, you consider, physics and biomechanics and lever systems, and then you extrapolate based on those biomechanical rules from physics what that consequences of that would have been. And in 1974, a group of folks at Harvard at the Concord Field Station published a study in which they measured the energetic cost of locomotion in three species, the cheetah, the goat, and the gazelle. Now, cheetah and goat, if you picture them in your mind's eye, mm-hmm. have, you know, quite delicate limbs, and I mean, particularly they taper distally toward the end of the limb. Mm-hmm. And the cheetahs, on the other hand, have heavier limbs, and they don't taper. I have to answer this. Okay, so you'd expect that the cost of locomotion, based on biomechanical principles, would be quite a bit higher in the cheetah because it's swinging these heavy and limbs back and forth, and with heavy, you know, distal, the part of the limb that moves the fastest is the foot or the hand. Mm-hmm. And so it's got these heavy things that it's flinging through the air. You would expect that their cost of locomotion would be higher. And what they showed in this publication in Science was that there was no difference. Hmm. And I didn't see this in 1974. I didn't come upon this until late 70s, probably. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, fill in the blank. Here we've been going around extrapolating from biomechanics, and that may just not be relevant. Now, there are other things. There were some weird things about that study. This was an early study out of that lab. The cheetah, the physiology of a cheetah is quite a bit different than the physiology of a goat or a gazelle. That could have made a difference. Their air variance was huge. Running wild animals on a treadmill, you know, there's, you know, that's a little weird. And so that you could quibble about their experimental design, but on the other hand, it made me think, and I think made a number of other people in the field suddenly realize that this Blythe, you know, making conclusions based on biomechanics, things weren't that simple. And so I decided that I needed to quit doing that, and instead I needed to go into the laboratory and say, what are the like energetic consequences of a particular structure? You know, what does this really do? Let's go measure it rather than just make extrapolations. Mm-hmm. And so I, at that point, basically pretty much abandoned physical anthropology for locomotor morphology and physiology and studies of the energetic cost of locomotion. And so I, and there was such a new field, and you know, getting a lab set up in a new field like that, it was just huge. And so I basically became a locomotor physiologist and did that for a number of years and, you know, came up with a number of conclusions. For example, if you, heavy distal limbs, in fact, are energetically costly. Longer limbs make you a more efficient walker and a more efficient runner. I've done kind of a bunch of things along those lines. Mm-hmm. So then, back in kind of did that throughout the 80s and early 90s. And then in, I think, 1994, I had a sabbatical coming. And I thought I would take this with a friend of mine, working with a friend of mine who was on the faculty at Brown, but whose husband was on the faculty at the University of Chicago, and that they kind of commuted back and forth, and, mm-hmm. and we thought that the semester I would be on sabbatical, she would be at University of Chicago, and I could just pop on down to Chicago, stay with them, and but, you know, of course not live with them for a long time because mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to die. That would work out. Well, then, with a few months before my sabbatical actually started, they discovered that they weren't going to be at the University of Chicago, and they were going to be some other completely different place where I couldn't go, mm-hmm. and, you know, productively. And so there I was, with this time off coming up for the sabbatical and no plan. And so I just sort of, you know, sort of started, you know, thinking a lot about what do I want to do with, I've got this time coming up, what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. So I hadn't been doing early hominid stuff for so long, and I just thought, Karen, Do you remember why you started this? You know, I was just so involved in locomotor energetics that I didn't think about early hominids anymore. But then I thought, the reason I did this was so that I could make generalizations to early hominids. So I just got a ton of stuff out of the primate library and just started reading the recent human evolution literature to see if there was anything there that I could contribute to based on what I'd learned. And sure enough, there was. And so I started applying back to early hominids, and I have had the best time. You know, it's somebody who's really collected some data who can really say something about certain mm-hmm. kinds of things. And so my work has been pretty well received.
So that would be one of what I would think would be one of your more significant contributions then to your field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's probably the most significant, is showing how you go into the lab, collect data, and get the factual basis for your predictions lined up before making the prediction. So yeah, I would say that's definitely the most significant contribution. And then plus, I think, so of course I was publishing these physical anthropology journals for some years before I switched out of there. And I think, you know, it was generally well-regarded work. And then I was absent, and I didn't publish in an anthropology journal for 10 or more years, because I was publishing all the stuff in the locomotor physiology journals. And so I think they, you know, maybe, who knows what they thought, I dropped off the face of the earth. So then when I came back, this is many years later, of course, mm-hmm. and so now I think there's a little bit of the venerability factor going here, that they sort of think, oh, okay, you know, started still kicking, you know, I've been around for a long time, and so they sort of know, a lot of people sort of knew who I was from before and see that I'm being very active again, and so it's been great. I review a lot more articles for publication mm-hmm. and so on, and I get good responses to the articles that I send in, and at a recent meeting, there was a recent physical anthropology meeting just a few weeks ago in Anchorage. I didn't go. Anchorage? I don't think so. You know, I just couldn't get myself to go up there. But my two grad student and my postdoc went, because of course, you know, the whole job market thing. And the postdoc and I had a poster that she did kind of working with me. And she told me that when people came around to the poster and found out she was working with me, they always said really nice things. But one person said, oh, she's just a legend. And I thought, you know, legend is somebody you talk about but isn't relevant currently. So I have to say that one kind of hurt. But it's funny. You know, I guess it's funny. And it just has to do with being in the field for kind of a long time, more or less. So yeah, that's kind of fun.
Now talk about, it's obvious that you have a lot of fun in your job. You love your you love the research part. You really enjoy the teaching, and it sounds like you like the publishing angle of it too.
Definitely.
Let's talk a little bit about committee work and being the department chair. And I know you must have been involved in things over the years in terms of committee work within your department. Have you been involved in any campus?
Oh yeah, work? Yeah. I did a fair amount. I at one point co-chaired the Letters and Science Curriculum Committee. Mm. I've chaired the Undergraduate Education Committee, which is the Campus Curriculum Committee. Mm-hmm. I for a long time chaired the University Bookstore Awards Committee for probably 10 years, mm-hmm. or maybe not quite that long, but mm-hmm. a long time. I was on the Faculty Honors Committee when the new honors, we kind of established the new honors requirements that are in force now. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of committee things of one sort or another.
And what are the positive things about committee work?
Well, I think I would say that I learned early that to choose the correct committees. I don't like turn the crank committees, where you're just, you know, you're just going, here are the rules, and you're kind of making sure that everybody follows the rules. Mm. I think those are boring. On the other hand, like the bookstore awards committee, you get to see, you know, a section, dozens of the best student projects done at the university this sure. year, mm-hmm. and select which are the best and give them awards. You know, that's pretty interesting to oh, get yes. a sense of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. To restructure the honors program, that was really interesting. The Letters and Sense Curriculum Committee, you can do things with the curriculum. So what I discovered, I mean, everybody has their limit for service, and I think people respect that. So what I made sure was that I was on a couple of significant, interesting committees, and then I would just turn down involvement in or you know, get off of committees that I found boring, and people were okay with that because I was already, you know, I was doing plenty of committee work. It's just mm-hmm. that I was able to pick and choose a little bit because mm-hmm. of doing things that way. So I, for the most part, haven't minded service. Mm-hmm. Being chair in our department has its merits. You get a one course reduction, mm-hmm. And you get a postdoc. And that means that somebody else does the nuts and bolts of research in the lab, and I can do the papers, which mm-hmm. I love doing. And frankly, a lot of faculty love being in the lab. I think it's important to be in the lab because you have to know the nuts and bolts of what happened with the data collection and so on. But to be in there, I don't love it. You know, I just don't. I love analyzing and planning and writing. And so I'm really glad to have the postdoc. As far as being chair, there are parts I like and parts I don't like. The parts I like are that I've been able to really help some of my colleagues. You know, people, when Monica Turner, one of my colleagues, was named to the National Academy, I looked at the salaries, and her salary was just silly for a National Academy member, and I appealed to the deans, and they came through. You know, mm-hmm. I've been working on getting her a university award. I was able to get her again from the deans, who were just great about this. Got her a dean's professorship, so she has a named chair. Previously, I think she was. I couldn't find another National Academy member on campus who didn't have a named chair. Hmm. And so, you know, I just thought, poor, you know, this just sends sure. such a bad message. I've gotten some raises for some others of my colleagues who I thought needed them. Mm-hmm. And I've done other sort of little things when people have needed something. Sometimes you can help. And mm-hmm. when you can, that's great, you know, and because right. you've sort of made a positive difference. And so that part I really like a lot. Mm-hmm. The downside is that your life is somewhat out of control in that you never know when the deans want something and they want it soon. Mm-hmm. And what you had planned to do this week is not going to be what's going to happen this week because you have to do this other thing.
Sure.
Also, now happily, at this point, we have a very collegial department. We have a couple of people who, you know, if they left, I would be happy. But they're not major trouble causers. Mm-hmm. And so in general, it's a collegial department, so it's a good atmosphere. Nonetheless, you know, hard things happen, and I don't particularly like dealing with some of those things. And not everyone is real easy to get along with, and when they have problems, you have to deal with them. Mm-hmm. But I just haven't found it that bad. Plus, I have really, really excellent administrators who are, nice. Are fun to work with mm-hmm. and very competent. And, you know, and I guess I'm open to taking on a certain amount of supervisory things. You know, you know, thinking ahead to a couple of little talks I have to have with some people, and I won't enjoy that at all. On the other hand, it has to happen.
Sure.
Because things have to change. And so I guess, you know, I guess so. I guess I'll. Somebody has to do it.
Right.
And I'm. I guess I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm. You've touched on this a little bit in your own department, and the question has to do with the climate of women here on the campus. Do you think the climate for women has helped or hindered participation and advancement of women on the campus?
Well, I don't. It's hard for me to generalize beyond my own field because mm-hmm. I haven't. I guess I was on the diversity 2006 committee, but that was really not so much about gender. It was more about racial and sexual and all those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess kind of what I would experience, what I experienced, I am supposing would have been general, that back in the 70s and maybe into the 80s, that there was, certainly in my department, there was a lot of just unconscious sexism going on. And people's ideas hadn't changed from where they had been back in the 50s enough. And there were people who grew up then and who just, it just hadn't occurred to them that things had changed. And I would think that would be general. I remember, this is so bizarre, I remember sitting around with my ex-husband and they had a quiz in the paper, is this comment sexist or not? And we were taking the quiz. And one of the comments was, he lets his wife work. We just kicked that one around for quite some time. We couldn't decide if that was sexist or not. You know, he lets his wife work sounds kind of sexist, but he's letting her work. It was a weird time, you know, I realized I was sexist, you know, I just had these expectations that that I'd never thought to question. And so I mean, now, of course, I'm a scientist. In the humanities, they may have been more aware of these things earlier. You would think they probably should be. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was better in the humanities, but I don't know. I do think at this point I see a lot of women being hired and, you know, being in searches. I see a lot of women in, you know, higher up positions mm-hmm. on campus. So it seems I see nothing to make me think that my experience isn't general. But on the other hand, I don't know.
Well, now, just if you talk a little bit about your life after work, if you would describe your family, how you balance work and family, and then what do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working?
Okay. So I live with my current husband, and he has a stepdaughter who's almost 20, mm-hmm. and she is currently in town, and we see her quite a bit, but she doesn't live with us, so... And my parents are still alive. My brother lives in Seattle.
Are your parents still in Beaver Dam?
No, they've been out of there for a long time. They're now, they live in Freeport, Illinois, which is about an hour and a half south of here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very easy. But in the wintertime, they go to Tucson, and that's where they are now. So mm-hmm. I don't see them that much in the wintertime.
And I interrupted you. You said you have a brother?
Yeah, in Seattle.
Okay.
And who's, you know, after all these years, is still the apple of my eye. He's one of those people, he's one of the small array of people who always makes me happy just to see him. You know, I love him, my brother. And my husband and I live in a downtown condo, and so I walk to work, which is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a Hilldale professor in the history of medicine and science, mm-hmm. and he says he's not a workaholic, but he works an awful lot of the time. So I mean, chiefly when he takes off is when we go on vacation. So we vacation a fair amount, which is real, really an important thing. So that's kind of my what I do there. In the summertime, I feel like I'm very good at balancing work and pleasure. It's just so, everything is so much fun. There's so many events around town to go to, right, which I love. I haven't been playing tennis recently, but I've been biking a lot. And from downtown, you've got access to all the Madison bike trails.
Sure.
So I get a lot of biking in the summertime. I would say that's my chief recreation is biking, and it's perfect because it's you bike for an hour or two, before or after work, and then you can work, but you feel really good while you're working, and so it's a really nice balance, I think. In the wintertime, I don't think I'm as effective at balancing work and personal. I have a tendency to become a bit of a drudge, I think, and where I really don't do much besides work in the summer, in the winter. I mean, I have friends over, we go out with friends, but I tend to work and not do enough of other things. It's just harder.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think that's a problem. And so I guess the fact that I'm not actively mothering my stepdaughter, except on rare occasions, I don't have to balance that. My husband is pretty self-starting in terms of working on his various things. So it's
what's his name?
Ronald Numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have to caretaking him. I fix dinners occasionally, that sort of thing. So that part of balancing it isn't too difficult. More recently, I've been flirting a little bit with yoga. Liz, my stepdaughter, has been taking yoga training. She's been trained to be a yoga teacher. And she needs to practice. And I've offered myself as willing guinea pig. And I really like it. I think she's the best yoga teacher I've ever seen. She's amazing. And so I've been kind of doing that. And that's kind of nice. And this is kind of early on here, so I'm not a serious person along those lines yet. But I'm thinking maybe that will help me have another sort of side for next winter, particularly. I mean, not that I wouldn't do it at all over the summer, but
sure,
that it might be another active thing to be involved with in the in the wintertime, to be less of a drudge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have any more questions.
Okay.
Is there anything else you'd like to get on the record here before we finish?
I'm so glad the climate has changed to the way it is now from the way it was when I was an assistant professor. What a relief. I'm just really glad about that.
I don't blame you. Well, thank you very much.
You bet.